Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you for coming to this talk. I'm an economist by training. Over the years, I tried to combine economics and behavior economics and a little bit of data mining, trying to understand how people make decisions about privacy and what are the consequences of those decisions. I hope that the privacy component of my talk will come out immediately. The augmented reality component of my talk, I hope that will be also obvious by the end of the talk, because what I'm trying to do is to combine different streams of research I've been interested in the past few years. I will start, when I try to show what I do, I like to use a few images, which interestingly enough have nothing to do at all with economics. The first image, and maybe the only person in the room who can recognize this is up here on the second row, is from a Roman general, Quinto Cincinnato, who back in the time of when Rome was still a republic, was called, because of his previous ability in leading the Roman army, was called back to save Rome against some northern invaders. He successfully completed the job as consul. In the period, in fact, he had become the only single consul. Usually Rome had two at the same time, but in periods of extreme trouble, they would resort to one. And then after having defeated the northern invaders, he gives back the signs of war and power in his right hand, and with his left hand is holding tools for agricultural work, which also mean going back to private life. So he gives back his role in the public life of Rome to go back to his private life, because Rome was so happy with him that wanted this guy to keep holding power even after the war. Privacy was very important in Roman culture, as well as in Greek culture. Alan Westin, I guess many of you know him for his beautiful 1967 book on democracy and privacy. He's been writing, working on a book on privacy for cultures and for times, and he has a chapter on privacy in the Greek culture. But also publicity was very important in Greek culture. Here I have a reconstruction of a temple, which used to be one of the ancient wonders, architectural wonders in the old days, the temple of Artemis, the Greek goddess, in Ephesus. Ephesus at the time was a Greek colony, although physically, geographically, it's in current Turkey. And this temple was destroyed to this. These are the only things which exist, remain of the temple. And not because of a war, not because of weather, not because the temple had been badly built, but because the act of one single man. This man wanted publicity, wanted to remain famous, wanted his name to be immortal. And he didn't find a better way of achieving that form of immortality than destroying one of the most famous temples of his age. So the citizens of Ephesus captured him, killed him, of course, and also did what is called damnatio memoriae in Latin, so damnation of memory. They tried to remove every single instance of his name from any record ever available, so that his goal, his dream of becoming immortal, would not be achieved. But in fact, a historian, Strabus, was able to say the name. His name is Erostratus, or Erostratus. So what am I trying to do here? I'm trying to show opposite examples of the desire for privacy and the desire for publicity in the good old days, because even in the recent days, we still have this desire for publicity, even bad publicity. The famous Facebook group, 30 Reasons Why a Girl Should Call It a Night, where girls would post photos of themselves in various states of being passed out, even vomiting and so forth. As well as at the same time as this Facebook group became famous, there was also the Beacon controversy when Facebook users, maybe, who knows, even some users who had posted photos of themselves in various states of drunkenness were protesting against Facebook being too invasive with the data through the Beacon tool. So the story I'm telling is that there are these seemingly contradictory forces inside each of us, need for publicity, need for privacy. And this is something that I'm interested in, because I see it as an issue of control over personal information, as well as an issue of trade-offs, the trade-offs associated with protecting or revealing data. So these are the questions I'm interested in. What are these costs and benefits associated with revealing something about yourself or protecting something about yourself? How do we make decisions about these costs and benefits, these trade-offs, and in fact, how rational these decisions are? Because sometimes we may be thinking that we are doing the right thing, but in fact, we realize later on, and we regret that we made a mistake. We reveal too much, or maybe we reveal too little. What are the long-term consequences of these decisions, and in particular, how are technologies, and in particular, the convergence of a set of new technologies going to impact the way we make decisions about privacy and personal data and those consequences? So this is what I call the economics and the behavioral economics of privacy. Most of my early work was pure, you know, classical economics. For those of you who study econ, is the kind of econ which is pretty much mainstream in any US program. Utility maximization over time, agents are rational, fully informed, and so forth. Not always the trade-offs we were considering were, strictly speaking, monetary. I'll give you an example of a fun paper which we still have not published, but we feel quite confident about the results. And the paper is aptly named GANs, Privacy and Crime. It's an example of economics of privacy and economics of security where there is no money involved. The story goes like this. The Commercial Appeal is a Memphis, Tennessee newspaper, decided in 2009 to reveal publicly the name and the zip codes of all gun permit owners in the state of Tennessee, causing, of course, huge negative reaction by the NRA as well as by privacy advocates. The NRA, in particular, accused the journal, the newspaper, of putting the safety of legal gun permit holders at risk by revealing their names and the zip code of their addresses. The newspapers replied, well, it's the opposite. If a criminal now knows that the person has a permit, maybe they will try to avoid where the person lives. And we thought that this was a testable hypothesis, because we could access the database that the Commercial Appeal still keeps online. Anyone can go, and on the right-hand side, there is an example of the kind of results you get after you search for all gun permit owners for a given zip code. We also got zip-level crime data, burglaries, shootings, theft, for 15 weeks prior to the publication of the database, and 15 weeks following the publication database. And then we started looking with what econometricians call a difference in difference model for statistical significant changes in crime patterns before and after as function of the gun density in a given zip code. What we found was that there were no changes for all crimes except one type of crime. Which one do you think it was? Burglaries. Specifically burglaries, more than theft. So burglaries went statistically significantly down compared to prior to the publication in zip codes with higher than median gun density, and went statistically significantly up in zip codes with lower than median gun density, suggesting that criminals have started using online data for offline crimes. Of course, the usage of online data for online crimes is very well known. There is a room here on our left, on your right, which is discussing exactly that at this very moment. Now, that said, although most of my early work was economics of privacy, and I still like to do something like that, such as this paper, I really became interested in the behavior economics of privacy. Behavior economics is by now is no longer a heterodox field in economics. It was when it started in the 1970s. Now it's well accepted by most economists that our behavior as economic agent is not fully rational, at least not as described in the 101 econ textbook. we suffer from incomplete information. In the case of privacy, we often don't know our data is being gathered, and often we don't know, even if we know it is gathered, we don't know how it will be used. We suffer from bounded rationality. I'm using the term in the original Herbert Simon sense of we are finite in our time available to process all the possible consequences of revealing or not revealing. Therefore, we resort to simplify heuristics to make the decision whether to reveal or not. And then even if we had complete information and unbounded processing power to think about all the possible consequences, we are still affected by a number of cognitive and behavioral biases, such as immediate gratification bias. I tend to gratify my immediate self by posting a cute but maybe embarrassing photo of myself because I get people clicking on like. I don't think about the long-term effect because of hyperbolic discounting. And then that led me, of course, to focus on online social networks, which is a great experiment in the wild of self-revelation. And pretty much my talk today will be about these two areas. I will try to bridge the two of them by discussing first three studies related to behavior economics and privacy, and then a more recent study which is about the convergence of online social networks, face recognition, and cloud computing, and what implication this has for our privacy. And finally, I will try in the final few slides of my talk to speculate a little bit about the convergence of the two, in the sense the convergence of face recognition, cloud computing, and social networks, and how we will react to that kind of future where we can be re-identified and pretty much anonymity is being eroded. You will see that this is a common theme through my slides. So let me start with the first three studies, which are more behavioral. One is about inconsistency in privacy evaluations. This is an older study, so I will spend only a few slides on it. I don't presume that you have seen it, but some of you may have. I use it even if it's old, like 2 or 3 years old, because it really drives home a very simple example of the kind of biases which affect your and my evaluation of privacy. Then I will talk about the paradoxical effect that control has on privacy. We like to think of privacy in terms of control of personal information, and that in a normative sense. By normative, I mean how the world should be, makes sense. The problem is that in a positive sense, and I'm using the economic distinction between normative statements and positive statements. Positive statements are about the world as it is. I will show you that more control paradoxically leads to less privacy. And you will see what I mean in a few slides. And then when you talk about discounting past information, kind of a new area we are branching out, where we are trying to not just try to study how people make decisions about their privacy, but what is instead the impact of your personal data on other people? How other people react to you based on what they know about you? And there are some interesting, I hope, and potentially gloomy implications that I will show you. And finally, as I mentioned, this new work, we call it Faces of Facebook, about face recognition and privacy. So let me start with the inconsistency of privacy evaluations. All this work, by the way, all of them are joint studies with other folks at CMU. In this case, Leslie John, PhD student at CMU, and actually just got a job at Harvard, graduated and got a job, and George Lowenstein, professor at CMU. So the inconsistency of privacy evaluation. The question we started from was very, very simple. Can we radically change the valuations that people give to the privacy of their personal information? And by radically, I really mean we wanted to see whether we could swing it by a lot. And we wanted to see whether, in fact, more precisely, people assign very, very different values depending on whether you frame the problem in two subtly different ways. What is your willingness to accept money to give away personal information? What economists call the WTA. And in particular, what is the minimum price, not the maximum price? The maximum price would be, you know, $2 billion. What is the minimum price that I can offer you, and you're willing to accept to give me your health records, to allow me to put online your health records, versus what is your willingness to pay, the WTP, the maximum price you're willing to pay in order to protect information? So, for instance, what is the maximum price you're willing to pay to avoid me from putting your health records online? According to neoclassic economics, the two numbers are actually the same. The minimum WTA is equal to the maximum WTP because that's called the reservation price. It's the point where you are indifferent between owning the good or owning the money. But in fact, studies in this area of so-called endowment effects show that individuals tend to assign a higher value to their to the willingness to pay, even for goods that they have only for a few seconds. There have been experiments with mugs, coffee mugs in the lab, and subjects who just own a mug for a few seconds, they are endowed with the mug, they start valuing the mug much more. So we wanted to see how this will play in the privacy field, because constantly we have to make these kind of decisions when we are online. Do we want to use Google or Bing for our searches, knowing that we get something back from that, very useful results, but we're also selling effectively our data to the Google, to Bing, and so forth? Or do we want to spend time using privacy-enhancing technologies, maybe Tor, in order to protect our data? Spending what? Well, time. Tor is free, but there is a cost. Your browsing gets delayed by some fraction of time. That's a way to buy for your privacy. So we wanted to see how much this evaluation would change. So we went to a shopping mall outside Pittsburgh, and we asked our subjects, who were, you know, patrons of the shopping mall just passing by, whether they wanted to participate in a survey. The survey was a decoy, it was an excuse of no interest whatsoever to us, except to create the parvance in their mind that that was the study. In reality, the study was what happened at the end of the survey, when they were paid for having participated in the survey. As a thank you for their participation, we gave them gift cards, Visa gift cards, the type of cards which can be used both online and offline. What we manipulated was the value in dollars of the gift card and its privacy features. So, to one group of subjects, and this is our randomized experiments, which means that we have these subjects and we randomly assign to different versions of this study where we manipulate something. One group of subjects got an anonymous gift card initially, a $10 card. And they were told your name will not be linked to the transactions completed with this card. Its usage will not be tracked by the researchers. Another group of subjects instead was given a $12 card and was told that your name will be linked to the transaction completed with the card and its usage will be tracked. Okay? So far, nothing particularly exciting. But then what we did, after each subject in any given group had been endowed with a card for around maybe 40 or 50 seconds, the subject was told about the existence of the other card. So the subjects who were given initially a $10 card were told, oh, by the way, we have another card, $12. So do you want to swap your $10 card and get a $12 card, $2 more valuable, but now we will track the transaction you do and link them to your name? In other words, you want to get two more dollars to give away to us your future transaction data. The other subjects who started from a $12 card were asked, oh, by the way, there is a $10 card. Would you like to swap your $12 card for a $10 card? This card is $2 less valuable, but the privacy of your future transaction records will be protected because we are not going to link your transaction to your name. Interestingly, if you think about it, there was absolutely no difference whatsoever in the decisions that subjects had to face. They were facing exactly the same two alternatives, regardless of which condition they had been assigned to. They simply had to decide between a $10 card with privacy and a $12 card with no privacy. No difference whatsoever. The only thing we changed was the framing, the psychological framing of how we presented the problem to them. By the way, there were two additional conditions, which I didn't put here because I wanted to keep the story simple. The two additional conditions were the conditions in which we didn't endow them, even for 40 seconds. We presented both cards at the same time, with a piece of paper describing the cards. In one of these two additional conditions, first we described the $10 card with these words, and then the $12 card. In the other piece of paper, same thing, only that the order was reversed. Why? Because we were interested also in order effects. We wanted to see whether privacy evaluations are so kind of malleable that you can impact them simply by changing the order of preferences, because people infer meaning from order. So these are the results we got. On the x-axis, I have the four different experimental conditions which I just described. On the y-axis, I have the percentage of subjects who chose, kept, or swapped the $10 anonymous card. So this is the first group of subjects. These subjects were given a $10 card, so endowed $10, and they were asked whether they were interested in swapping to a $12 card. Well, 52% said no. So more than one out of two said no. my privacy is more valuable than $2. I'm not giving you my transactions data for just $2 more. These were the subjects, instead, who were offered to choose both cards at the same time, and they saw the description showing first the $10 card and second the $12 card. Now we still have a pretty large number of people choosing the protected card, but it goes statistically significantly lower. Now it's 42%. Now this is a group who was again given a choice at the same time between the $10 and $12, only that the piece of paper described first the $12 and immediately after the $10. So very strong order effect. Now the percentage of subjects who choose the $12 card goes even further down. And finally, you see where it is going. I'm about to show the group of people who were given a $12 card and were asked whether you want to buy back a little bit of privacy by giving back $2. And once again, I would like to stress that all these subjects were facing exactly the same two alternatives. No difference whatsoever. They all had the time to think in terms of, well, I can get the $12 card and buy a Big Mac, or I can get a $10 card and buy Penthouse. If they wanted to think that way, not Penthouse, Penthouse magazine, not a Penthouse. You got it, sorry. And this is it. So less than 10% now choose the more privacy-protected card, which brings up the question, what is the value of privacy? Can we even pin down a valuation of privacy if we can swing from 50% choosing privacy to fewer than 10% choosing privacy in the very same scenario? So the rather troubling implication here is that we can swing a privacy valuation as well. We can swing security valuations and security behavior. The even gloomier implication, if you allow me to extrapolate and go out in a limb, is that if you see these results almost philosophically and you consider the first condition, the people who were given a $10 card, you see it as a world where your privacy is protected by default, versus you consider the last condition, the people who were given a $12 card, which by default made their data visible, but they could buy back privacy. If you see that condition as real life, our world where privacy is being eroded, and if we want privacy, we have to fight for it and pay for it, then the gloomy implication is that those who have privacy and start from a position of power value privacy much more. 52% of them keep their data for $2. Those who have less privacy, psychologically put in the frame of mind of you have no privacy, like Facebook CEO says, like Scott McNeil, Beckett, Sun used to say a few years ago, they will value privacy even less. So you have this sort of vicious circle. Less privacy, value privacy less, less privacy, value privacy less. But there is also the good side, perhaps, that this suggests that the endowment effect is by no means new in economics. We didn't claim of having discovered the endowment effect by no means, but it has important policy implication because it suggests that we cannot simply say that, oh, the market is stock and people don't care about privacy. I feel that the picture is more complex than that. The second study is about the paradox of control. And here we are really going at a topic which is very fundamental for in the privacy literature, the idea that privacy is a form of control over personal information. If you see most of the literature in this area, you really see a positive correlation between the two. Or at most, no correlation in the sense that the authors are not really discussing between the connection between the two of them. Well, we wanted to see whether, paradoxically, more control can lead actually to less privacy. And what do I mean by this? Well, the story goes like this. Well, there is control on whether you disseminate or not something about you, which usually you are almost in complete control of, or in most scenarios. For instance, you decide whether to upload something to Facebook or not. You decide whether to use a certain search engine without using Tor. Versus the control on who will access the data. And yes, Facebook and other social networks have some level of granular controls on who can see your information, but really you cannot stop, given what we know now and the usability of access control technology, you really cannot stop anyone from taking a photo that you uploaded, posting somewhere else, or taking the email you sent and forwarding it out. So the point is, we were wondering whether people, when they think in terms of control, focus more on the first and if they forget the lack of control they have in the second. And this is problematic because really the privacy costs come from whether your data and how your data is accessed and used, not merely the fact that it is uploaded. The joke I use to explain this concept is if you upload a photo to the Facebook and no one is around to see it, does it make a sound? Right? So the reason why we thought that this could be important is driving together different streams of psychological literature. One is all the theories of saliency. People tend to pay more attention to things when they are more salient. It seems obvious, but the implications are important because the act of uploading something or revealing something is an act of agency. It's very salient. You are in power. You decide. The act of someone else abusing your data is much less salient because it doesn't have agency. It's someone else doing that. Even if the costs come from that, in your brain is not as salient, therefore it has lower weight in your decision process. You think about that less. Related to this, the problem of overconfidence. Many studies have shown that the more control you give or the more you make people feel more in control in something, the more confident they become and they start taking risk. A related example would be seatbelt laws, which for some type of people lead to faster driving because you feel protected by the seatbelt and therefore you end up taking more risk in the same scenario. So how did we test this? Well, we created a number of experiments. And the way we, in a way, operationalized this was by creating hypotheses based on our conjecture. One was the following, that if subjects are made feel, not necessarily given, but made feel more in control of the publication of their data, even though in reality they face the same or even higher objective risk associated with access and usage of the data, they will disclose more sensitive information or more widely sensitive information. Vice versa, if subjects are made feel less in control of their personal information, even though the risks are not changing or in fact are decreasing, they will disclose less because they feel less in control. So we did several experiments. In some we increase the perception of control, in some we decrease. We feel we have pretty much robust results. I will focus just on one of the experiments in which we made people feel more in control. And this is how we did it. This was with CMU students, more than 100. They completed an online survey. They were told that the survey was about, we wanted to do a study on ethical behavior. And therefore, we asked them questions about whether they had engaged in a number of activities. Some were not particularly sensitive. Have you ever been married? Some were pretty sensitive. Have you ever used drugs? And they had to answer yes or no. But they could also decide not to answer at all the question, leave it blank. We had, in a pre-study pilot survey, we had ranked the questions by their degree of sensitivity using a similar sample from the same population, but not, of course, an overlapping sample. So a different set of subjects from those who actually took experiment 3. Our main dependent variable, what we were really interested in capturing, and we wanted to see whether there would be statistically significant difference across experimental conditions, was whether they would answer the question or not. So this study actually had several conditions. I'm only presenting you, this being an invited talk, I want to give you the big picture, only two conditions. The first one, kind of the baseline, was the implicit control conditions. All the subjects were told all answers to this survey are voluntary. By answering a question, you agree to give researchers permission to publish your answer. Okay? And then we had a condition in which this publication was made more explicit. So all answers are voluntary. In order to give a researcher permission to publish your answer to a question, you'll be asked to check the corresponding box in the following page. So in other words, this is what we did. This is what some subjects saw, the ones who were randomly assigned to condition one, study on ethical behavior, important or answer voluntary, by answering a question you agree to give a researcher permission to publish your answer, and then the set of questions, yes, no, they probably are too small font for you to read. And this is instead the other group where instead was given the possibility of choosing whether or not to allow us to publish the answer. So they were given something more, and this something more was this column in which they could decide whether to allow us not just to use the results, but in fact publish their answers, okay? So we made them feel more in control of this, of the explicit publication, And by the way, status quo theory, the default setting bias status quo theory, would suggest that people leave that box unchecked because it's a small, but nevertheless non-zero cognitive cost because you have to go and check each little box, right? And it takes a little bit of time, and why not leaving just the default, which is what people usually do. Instead, we wanted to see whether by making people feel more in control, we would defeat the default setting bias, and in fact, people would be more likely not just to click the box, but in fact to answer the questions. And these are the results. The results I'm going to show are the publication rate. So not just who answer, but even who allow us to publish their results, okay? And I have two conditions. Condition one, the implicit control, and condition two, the explicit control. I'm splitting the questions into the two groups, the less intrusive and the more intrusive. Once again, as graded by a different sample of subjects from the same population. On the y-axis, I have the percentage of subjects who answer the questions. So what we see is that we have a very, very strong effect, whereas giving this additional box with the allowing us explicitly to publish, that permission was already in condition one, but was implicit. By making it explicit with a box, not only people did click on the box, but also were more likely to answer the questions. So you have this statistically significant increase in the propensity to answer and, in fact, to allow us to publish these answers. So the story here is that, by the way, we also did some manipulation checks at the end. We checked for perceived control and perceived sensitivity, and privacy sensitivity of the questions, and the results strongly support the interpretation we give to these findings, which is by making people feel in control, we are decreasing their concern. By decreasing their concern, we are making them reveal more sensitive information to more strangers. And this is, in a way, the gloomy implication that, in a way, this could also explain why often people get angry, not simply because something has been revealed about them, but because they didn't feel that they were the ones revealing. If I reveal a secret, I'm okay. If you reveal this very same secret which I was about to reveal, but you do it 1 second before me, it's not okay, because you have taken away from me this agency, this feeling of control, even if it doesn't really impact the objective cost of revelation. It also calls into question the argument that online social networks often use that, well, we are solving privacy issues by giving more control to users. And at the face level, who may disagree with that? Control is good. You want to give users control. But in fact, what we are driving here, go back to the distinction between a normative statement and a positive statement, more control is good in normative terms because ethically, morally, we feel that people should be in control of their data. In positive terms, more control can be a channel for more disclosures and more sensitive disclosures. At least this is what the results are suggesting. Now, the third study I'm going to talk about is about this branching out that I started recently in terms of how people react to your personal information. So not how you decide whether to reveal something personal or not, but once something about you is known, how would people react to that? And in particular, we were interested in something which is currently one of the hot topics in the privacy debate, the idea that the internet means the end of forgetting, because there is an eternal memory of everything we have uploaded or everything we will, everything we have ever done. And some say that it doesn't really matter that much because 10 years from now, 15 years from now, all of us will have their skeleton in their Facebook. All of us will have done something embarrassing online. And yes, there will be memory of that, but probably we will be lenient towards that because, you know, it's something we did when we were young or it's something which is, you know, 5, 10 years, 15 years ago. It doesn't matter any longer. We are a different person. Well, we were wondering whether human psychology works that way, whether we are really predisposed towards not just forgetting, but forgiving other people bad mistake simply because they're older. And of course, we didn't think that that was the case. We thought that we had this conjecture that people react to information about you very, very differently depending on two factors. How old the information about you is, Am I retrieving some information about you which comes from a Facebook profile updated one day ago? Or am I am I finding something about you coming from a CV dating 10 years back? And whether the information is good or bad, has positive or negative valence. So our conjecture was that in reality, information with negative valence have very long shelf life, is not discounted, or is discounted very, very, very slowly. Whereas information with good valence is discounted very, very quickly. So that, to give an example, if you hear that Mr. A has won an important prize, and this prize was awarded 1 month ago, your brain immediately thinks, oh, Mr. A is pretty cool. But if you hear that this prize was awarded 15 years ago, you probably immediately start thinking, okay, what has Mr. A been doing for the past 15 years? Instead, if I tell you that Mr. A did something bad, drove under the influence and ran over a pedestrian 1 month ago or 10 years ago, makes no difference. The negative power of that information remains the same. Now, of course, I chose an example which is somewhat biased because I chose something which could be could have a very strong negative connotation psychologically, driving under the influence, driving over a pedestrian versus winning an award. So we had to think in our experiments a way to control for that and present things in a leveled way. And you'll be the judge whether we succeeded in that. By the way, this is also, once again, related to other research, of course, in psychology, although the fact we believe we have found is quite novel. What has been found before in the literature, which was pretty cool, were two things. One is that people pay more attention to negative events than positive events. In fact, there is a paper in psychology called something like, I'm remembering the title correctly, something like bad is stronger than good. Sad but true. Events with negative valence have more impact on our decision making. Not only that, there are also been studies showing that people tend to remember negative events more than positive events. Somehow our brain works that way, and maybe there are evolutionary reasons and explanations for that. If you believe in evolutionary psychology, you can easily imagine a story where the ability of the gene for forgetting something good, let's put it this way. If our ancestors were drinking from poisonous water, the kind of gene forgetting about being told that a certain source of water is poisonous, if you forget about that, you die, and probably you're not going to pass that gene for forgetting bad negative events to others. If instead you forget about someone telling you that the source of water is particularly good or pleasant, not necessarily you die. It's an opportunity cost. You miss out, but not necessarily you die, and therefore not necessarily you're not passing on this gene to others. In other words, there may be reason why we tend to remember more these negative events. So the way we try to do it is that we run a number of survey-based randomized experiments, actually four rather than three, because we just ran a last one, which is not survey-based, was done with actual money, and we were pretty excited that it went perfectly. And we were manipulating something about a person, or in fact in one study, a company, something which was either good or bad about the personal company, and happening either in the recent times or in the past. And then we asked our real subjects what they thought about the company or the person. So we did it in three ways. One was the so-called dictator game. Anybody in this room remembers from Econ 101 or game theory what the dictator game is about? No computational game theorist or computer scientist interested in this kind of games? Okay, the dictator game comes from game theory. It's done often in the lab, and the idea is that there is a player who is the dictator and has to decide how to split a certain allocation, a cake or an allocation of money, like $1, between himself or herself and the opponent. And that's it. In the dictator game, that's only what happens. It's often done in a repeated version of the game, because you want to see how the other player, after having been subject to the dictator's will for a long time, how will then play against the dictator. Then there is another version, which is Ultimatum game, where the other player can actually veto. So as veto power. So I can decide as a dictator to allocate the $1 in 50 cents for me, 50 cents for you, and the other player probably will agree. Or I can decide $1 for me and zero for you, and the other person will probably veto, and no one gets anything out of the game, right? So in the dictator game, the dictator chooses everything, the other guy cannot choose anything. And what we did was we presented our subjects with dictators who had played either in the recent past or in the not so recent past, either in a very greedy way, keeping all the money for themselves, or in a more generous way, so allocating more money to their opponents. And we wanted to see how our subjects would play against those dictators with real money. So our subjects were playing with real money. And what we found was that people... Actually, let me hold on with what we found, because I want to keep this until I really show you the graph for the other study, and I go back to the dictator game. The company experiment was something done as a survey base, so not real money, asking people to judge a company which had either been involved in some kind of a tax fraud recently, 1 year ago, or 10 years ago, or some kind of tax transparency award, either 1 year ago or 10 years ago. And finally, the wallet experiment, the one I focus, I will focus on now on because it is an easier story to follow, is a story where we have a person, Mr. A, doing something with a wallet. And this something is either very good or pretty bad. And then we ask our subjects to judge Mr. A. So this is the, what our subjects saw. There were five experimental conditions to which they were randomly assigned. The subjects in the what we call the neutral baseline condition saw this description of Mr. A. They were asked to read the story of Mr. A, and then they were asked to make judgments about Mr. A. So these subjects read that Mr. A was born in San Diego, California, received social security number, vaccination, moved to Sacramento, attended high school, got driving license, after graduation moved to Texas, okay? So nothing exceptionally positive or exceptionally negative about Mr. A, baseline. Subjects who had been randomly assigned to another condition saw a slightly different version of Mr. A. There was a little bit more text about Mr. A, which I am highlighting in red. So these subjects also read that just about graduation, Mr. A found a lost woman purse containing $10,000 in cash, reported the discovery to the police, and a rightful owner retrieved the money. And then after graduation went to Texas, where he has been living and working for the past 12 months, okay? So what we gave was temporary information about when the good did happen. So the readers in the subjects who read this story knew that Mr. A did something pretty good, and this happened in the somewhat recent past. Other subjects read that Mr. A did find the purse, however, did not report the discovery to the police, and therefore the rightful owner did not retrieve her money. And once again, move to Texas, where he's been living for the past 12 months. So bad deed happening 12 months ago. Another group of subjects, we are going back to the bad negative information, sorry, positive, good positive information, found that Mr. A found the purse, brought it back, the rightful owner got their money, and this happened 5 years ago. Because we had this little information, moved back to Texas, where he's been moving, living for the past 5 years. And you see where this is going. The last condition is, of course, the bad deed. Mr. A doesn't bring back the wallet, and this happened 5 years ago. Okay. So to summarize, we had one neutral condition and what is called a 2x2 design, where we manipulated time 12 months ago, 5 years ago, valence of the information, positive, negative. Okay. So what we asked our subjects was something like, how much do you like Mr. A? Would you trust Mr. A? Would you like to work with Mr. A? Which are metrics used in the literature. I will focus on the first one. We asked it on a Likert scale 1 to 7, where 1 was, I do not like Mr. A at all, and 7 is, I like Mr. A lot. And these are the results. I will start with the neutral, the baseline condition, which is represented here in green. And I have on the horizontal axis, on the x-axis, the recent and old, referring to the story with the 12 months event happening or the story with the 5 years ago event happening. But of course, for the baseline, there was no wallet story at all. So the baseline is simply is a flat line. There is no difference between the recent and old because there was no event. And of course, it makes sense, these subjects, like Mr. A, kind of in the middle, 4.5. which kind of makes sense, because Mr. A was not incredibly a nice guy, not incredibly a bad guy from the baseline story. The subjects who read the positive version of Mr. A's story, where Mr. A finds the money and brings back the money to the police, well, if they were told, the subjects who were assigned randomly to the condition where they were told that this happened 12 months ago, were lacking Mr. A quite a bit. The number above on the recent column is close to 5.6, is statistically significantly larger than the baseline condition. The good deed positively impact Mr. A likelihood, statistically significantly so, while unfortunately, the same good deed, if presented as having happened 5 years ago, no difference whatsoever from the baseline. The implication here is that the good information, recent, positively impacts Mr. A. The good information, past, has zero value, as if Mr. A never did any such good deed. Not so much luck with the negative information. For the negative information, you have a very strongly statistically significant lower favorability likelihood of Mr. A, regardless of whether this happened in the recent past or in the distant past. There is no statistical significance in the two negative value recent and past. There is, of course, a very strong statistical significance between the negative values and the baseline or positive values. So the story here is that bad is not just stronger than good, which is something that the research had already shown. It seems that bad is also discounted very differently from good. It seems that our brain discounts positive information about you very quickly, and negative information about you not so quickly, or in fact, potentially not at all, which of course has policy implications because it tells us about, okay, the silly things that I'm doing today on Facebook, or the silly information which is related to me today, if it is still accessible 10 years from now, well, people just say, oh, it's so old, it doesn't matter, it was young, or will in fact judge me because of that. So the overall implication of this stream of studies, the behavioral studies, before I move on to the face recognition, the last part of my talk, are that people concerned for privacy and for security in part depend on priming and framing. This doesn't mean to me that people don't care. It doesn't mean that people are irrational, that they make stupid decisions about security, about privacy. That's not the moral of the story at all. It means that our decisions about privacy and security can be manipulated, and in fact, I would argue, are being manipulated. Pretty much, sometimes we joke about the fact that behavior economists and behavior marketing, behavior finance guy simply discover what the industry has been already doing for years. So in a way, it's good to be aware of the magnitude of swinging in behavior that we can cause with subtle changes in the way we present a problem. It also means that we cannot necessarily rely on reveal preference arguments. Reveal preferences is an argument used in economics to suggest that pretty much the marketplace, if you offer people decisions and you see how they decide, that's the end of it. From there, you can infer their true, right, and constant preferences. But in fact, behavior economists prefer to think that preferences are constructed. There doesn't exist a fixed, monolithically stable preference over privacy. There is a constructed preference which depend on context and which can be affected by manipulation. And this, in a way, leads me to the last part of the talk. And it may seem odd that I'm trying to correlate face recognition, online social network, to our studies on behavior, but these are all my studies, and really, I really feel that they are part of the same agenda that I'm trying to drive, which is where technology is bringing us and how it is impacting our ability to think about and act about privacy problems. So these studies, we call it Face to Facebook, Privacy Face Recognition, is indeed about face recognition. Now, face recognition has been around for a long time, more than 40 years. We also know there was a beautiful, the best sentence summarizing the state of face recognition research comes from a Black Hat talk 1 or 2 years ago. I cannot recall right now the name of the speaker, Joshua. I remember only his first name, Joshua. He said, face recognition sucks, but it's getting better. And I subscribe to that. Computers are still way worse than humans in recognizing faces, but they keep getting better and better. So much so that you start having applications for recognition, not just in security, but also in Web 2.0. In fact, if you look at the trends in this area, you see that the big Silicon Valley players have been aggressively going on a shopping frenzy for face recognition startups. Google has acquired Naven Vision Ria and PitPat. PitPat is the face recognizer that we use in our experiment. Interestingly enough, it comes from CMU. When we started working, it was completely off the shelf available. And then pretty much 2 weeks ago, right at the end of, after we finished our own experiments, it was acquired by Google just very recently. Apple has acquired Polaroid and started using face recognition in iPhoto. Actually, Apple already, I guess, probably even as back as 2009, started using some form of face recognition iPhoto. Facebook, of course, is licensing face.com technology, an Israeli startup, to do the automated tagging, which has become so popular on Facebook. So there is all this activity in this area. Were we trying to do something different? I think so, because what we were interested in researchers was the convergence of a number of different technologies. What we wanted to see is what happens when you combine together into a big calderon, into a big saucepan, different technologies and the trends, which are pretty clearly going in the direction of more of less and less anonymity possible in online and offline. You'll be the judge after I show our results. So the first trend, increasing public disclosure in online social network, especially photos. In the year 2000, there were about 100 billion photos shot worldwide. This is an estimate which I found in an article published last year in Science, the peer-reviewed scientific journal. The author estimated it based on sales of cameras, and from that they could estimate the order of magnitude approximation how many shots had been taken worldwide. And of course, a fraction, small fraction of them went online. You know, back in 2000, there was no Facebook to talk of, and so forth. In 2010, Facebook members alone were uploading 2.5 billion photos in a single month. Okay? This gives you a sense of the magnitude that we are talking about here. Not only that, but these photos are often uploaded through identified profiles, profiles which have a first and last name. That's the first trend. The second trend, face recognizer continue to improve. Yes, they suck, but they're getting better. So a program by the Department of Defense called the Ferret program tried to measure the evolution in accuracy of this recognizer. Between 97 and 2006, there was an increase of almost two orders of magnitude. If you see the performance of recognizer now, it's definitely orders of magnitude better in 2006. Just to give you an anecdotal example, we started our experiments with a PitPat 4.2 or 4.1, and then as we were doing our studies, around maybe March or February, we got PitPat 5.2, and we could see a statistically significant change in the accuracy. And 4.1 was just maybe 10 months older than 5.2. So you really see this in front of your eyes, this continuous improvement. Other trends, which are all converging together, statistical re-identification, all this work in which combines data mining, statistics, and so forth, showing that you can, A, connect two databases and re-identify person in database A from data in database B, or you can find much more sensitive information about a person in the database. And of course, LaTanya Sweeney, 1997 study, started pretty much this area. There was a very famous study on Netflix, re-identifying Netflix Prize members with the Internet Movie Database. There was our own study on predicting social security numbers from Facebook profiles, or in general from public data, such as date of birth and hometown, and so forth. Another trend, which is also converging here, cloud computing. It means that you can use a tool like a mobile phone, which itself doesn't have the computational power of running, you know, 100 million face comparison in a few seconds. You just need to connect to the internet, and cloud computing can allow to do that in relatively fast and cheap means, and indeed ubiquitous computing. So things like smartphones, which allow you to connect to the internet and to unleash the power of cloud computing. So pretty much we wanted to see whether the convergence of this technology is making something possible. And it's mass scale or large scale automated peer-based face recognition, leading to individual identification and inference of additional potentially sensitive personal data. Let me explain what I mean by this. Large scale, meaning we are not just doing with a small group of people, we are talking about hundreds of thousands and perhaps millions. Automated, very quick to use, just one click and you get the information. Peer-based, I talk about this in terms of democratization of surveillance, and sadly I'm not using the term with a positive connotation. I mean that we are pretty much getting very close to the day where anyone in the street could infer sensitive information from you, from your face, using these technologies. We are not there yet, by no means, but I really think we are getting there. And you will be the judge based on what I'm trying to show you. The individual re-identification is only one part of the story we're trying to tell. So giving a name to a face, finding a match between databases is only the beginning. We wanted to see whether we could infer something much more sensitive about that person. So in a nutshell, this is what we are trying to do. You start from an unidentified database, a face which is anonymous, a face which has not a name connected to it. This face could come from match.com, where people, a dating site where people use photos of themselves, but otherwise you don't go out on a date, but they don't put their names because there is social stigma, there are issues, potential security issues, and so forth. It could be open webcam, it could be photo repositories like Tumblr or Flickr, or it could be your face in the street. You can see your face in the street as part of this unidentified database of anonymous faces walking around you in the downtown of San Francisco. And then you have an identified database online, some digital photos of you with names. And this is becoming more and more common. As I was mentioned, in 2000, almost no one had identified faces publicly available about themselves for others. Now we do, and we do it especially through the Facebook. We also do it through LinkedIn. We do it for organizational rosters where we put our photos and our names. I would argue that for most of you in this room, including me, there is one identified photo that is publicly available to all the rest of us if we start Googling your name. So the idea is that face recognition looks for a match between the two images, two versions of the photo of the face of the same person. If it does, then you can now give the name that you have taken online to the up till then anonymous face. But then, because statistical re-identification techniques have shown that you can start from publicly available data, Facebook profile, LinkedIn profile, other information, and you can infer something much more sensitive starting from that, social security number in the case of our 2009 study, but also sex orientation in the case of MIT study, credit score, this is another ongoing study we are doing, and so forth. You name it, you can think of it, someone will do it. So because of this, once you have a linkage between the name and the sensitive information, you can, of course, lead back the inference to the anonymous face. So this is the story I'm talking about, a story of data accretion, starting from an anonymous face and in a few seconds ending up with very sensitive information about that person. So, by the way, the issue is broader than Facebook, but the reason why I focused on Facebook in the previous slide and we use Facebook data in our experiments was the following. The Facebook primary profile photos are visible by default, and you cannot even change that. Facebook privacy policy says Facebook is designed to make it easy for you to find and connect with others. For this reason, your name, profile pictures, do not take privacy settings. The only way you can make not happen is if you don't use a photo of yourself as primary profile picture. But in fact, our data shows that a vast majority of Facebook members use photos as their primary profile picture. Not only that, we did a survey of about 500 Facebook users, and we tried to see whether they were using their real first and last names on Facebook. It turns that around 89, close to 90% of them do. So there is a 10% of users who don't use their real names, but this percentage compared to Friendster, MySpace is much, much smaller. Remember, Friendster had all these fakester, all these completely fake profiles. Facebook is not like that. In fact, it's quite aggressively going after fake profiles. By fake profiles, I mean profiles without... I should not use the term fake profile because it's profiles under pseudonym. So, and this is a picture which tells a thousand words. This is a Facebook picture. What we did, we wrote a script which takes the picture and basically visualizes the you know that you can tag people on Facebook, right? So what our script does, visualizes the area covered by the tag that someone is assigned to a face, and the Facebook ID of that person. Okay, so those are the red squares. The white square is instead what our recognizer, one of the faces that our recognizer found, and in this moment, the recognizer was focusing on the face of the blonde girl at the start. So the story we are telling, I feel that this tells really more than 1,000 words, because it's the recognizer is finding the same face, which is also tagged. The tag leads to a Facebook ID. The Facebook ID leads to the name. The Facebook profile then can lead from the name to additional sensory information. This is this is the big picture. So the three experiments we did were one online to online re-identification from Facebook to a dating site. The second, offline to online. So from the street, actually from CMU campus to Facebook. And the third one was about inferring more sensitive information. So I will only give you the quick summary of the results, because this is a talk where I try to give a larger panorama of all our research. I'm, of course, happy. There is many more details available, which I'm happy to discuss with you afterwards. In the experiment one, we started from a very popular American dating site. We took photos from this dating site. Then we took photos from Facebook. Let me rephrase that. We took photos about Facebook. We didn't even need to log on the Facebook to get these photos, because we simply use a search engine API to get what of a Facebook profile is available on the search engine. You know that most of us make our profile searchable on search engine, our Facebook profile searchable on search engines. And so if you Google someone's name and that person Facebook profile is searchable, you will find their snapshot information, a photo and a name and some very basic small snapshot data. That's what we used. And we combined the two using PitPat face recognizer, and we ended up re-identifying a person by finding their Facebook profile. Doing this, we were able to find in a certain geographical area, this was the Pittsburgh area, one out of two members of the dating site. We were taking a very conservative approach, because we were only considering the very first match found by the recognizer out of the hundreds of thousands that the recognizer could find. What that means is that the first recognizer returns matching scores that tell you whether a given pair of faces is likely to be or not the same person. And we only use the highest rank pair. And this is conservative, because what really troubles face recognizers today is not false negatives, is not as much as the person is there, you cannot find it, is false positive. Is the idea that sometimes you don't find the real person as the first hit. You find it as the second or the third or the fourth. Why? Because in reality, we are not that much beautiful and unique snowflakes as we like to believe. In reality, our faces are very much similar to each other. When you start working with large databases, hundreds of thousands or millions of people, you realize that certain faces are really, really similar. So here we were going conservative. In the next study, the offline to online, we were going less conservative. We were considering results in the top 10 out of hundreds of thousands matched pairs. We took photos in the Heinz Fourier at CMU, and we compared them to photos coming from Facebook profiles. So can you find what the recognizer found here? Are you as good as the recognizer? This guy? Right. And that was indeed a match. And in this experiment, we re-identify one out of three of the subjects who participate in the study. Now, so far, what we had done was to show that we can take a face in the street. And this is, of course, a control experiment. This is just, a proof of concept. But really, I think that 5-10 years out, this will become reality. So we took a photo in our virtual street. In reality, was a campus building. We used PitPat, face recognizer, and we were able to find a matching photo from a Facebook profile from which we can infer the name, right? However, in 2009, 2 years ago, Ralf Gross and I published a paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science in which we showed that we could predict social security number from public data. And the public data, date of birth and state of birth, could be inferred for many students from their Facebook profiles. So we took Facebook profiles, we combined it to the DEF master file, which is a completely, utterly, publicly available database of social security numbers of people who are dead, and by using some statistical tools, we ended up recognizing the SSN of people who are alive. So you see where I'm going with this, right? Is I call it kind of the not really the transitive property of personal information, kind of the additional property of personal information. It's as simple as adding 1 + 1. You take a photo, you find a Facebook profile, you end up predicting a social security number. So the last experiment was indeed about predicting social security number from faces. So what we did, we recontacted the subjects of experiment 2, and we tested our predictions on them. We predicted two types of information: interest, an example of something personal but not particularly sensitive, and we predicted social security number, as an example of something much more sensitive. And for 27% of the subjects, we were able to identify the first 5 digits with 4 attempts. By the way, this is pretty good in the sense that the first 5 digits, there is a misconception sometimes. I've read it in some outlets. Oh, the first 5 digits are built in by default, knowing your date of birth and hometown. It's not true. If you don't have the right algorithm, you have a 0.0014% probability of getting the first 5 digits right, unless you have the right algorithm. Now, what we did in experiment 3 was asynchronous, because, as I said, we called back the subjects. Well, we did a survey calling back the subjects. But we wanted to see whether we could do this in real time. So we developed an iPhone app. The iPhone app basically does everything which the other experiments did, but in real time. So it takes a shot of someone's face and then looks for a matching face, either from publicly available primary profile photos, Facebook profiles, or from rosters, and so forth. If it finds the name, then it tries to query. If it finds also a publicly available, accessible Facebook profile, it tries to find the demographic data for that person. If it does not, it tries to query search services such as usapeoplesearch.com in real time, and tries to get the demographic information from those services. Puts it into our SSM prediction engine, which developed in 2009, our algorithm, and spits out the SSN of the person on top of the screen of the camera. So pretty much it's an example of augmented reality application, right? Augmented reality is really, really a cool area of computer science investigation. Here is an example where you're pointing your iPhone in a certain direction, and because of GPS and data gathered online, you can see that you are pointing at Lake Florida. What we did is something similar in that with our app shows, if it finds a match for the face, shows, you cannot really see it. It was an unfortunate selection of font color and size. It is a little white, but pretty much is, in this case, an R-coded social security number for one of our RAs. So what were we trying to do here? What are the current limitations? This is a proof of concept. Face recognition is currently still highly limited. First of all, the accuracy is limited. There are many false positives. Availability of facial images, you cannot find facial images for everybody, although I would bet that for most of you in this room, there are facial images online. There are the challenge that in our experiments, we were using cooperative subjects, in the sense we were using nice, cute, clean frontal photos. If you're trying to re-identify someone in the street who is uncooperative, then you're not going to get a frontal photo. If you don't get a frontal photo, the accuracy of the face recognition goes down. Furthermore, there are geographical restrictions. In our first experiment, we focused on the Pittsburgh area, dating site users, around 330,000 individuals. In the second experiment, we were focusing on CMU students, about 25,000 individuals. These are small stats. When you try to escalate these to nationwide face recognition, now you face two big problems. If you are trying to match a shot you take in the street to a database of, say, 150 million images, A, there is a problem of computational time, B, there is a problem of more false positives which are going to pop up. So currently, off-the-shelf, real-time face recognition of anyone, everywhere, all the time, is not yet possible. However, the point is that it will be possible. For all the limitations I discussed, the technological trend is pretty clear where it's going. Face recognizers are getting better. They're even getting better in using non-frontal shot. You have more data available. More computational power will be available. increasingly so in the coming years and so forth, which leads to the bigger issue. Where is this going? And to me, and this is the point I made earlier of this talk, is that the direction that this is going is that anonymity is truly being eroded online and offline, because we are truly walking into a world where a stranger in the street could make inferences which are sensitive about you, starting from simply your face. And this is challenging to me, because I came to this community. This is a honor for me to be a Usenix for the first time, but some of you are also in the community that I used to frequent more, such as the PET, the Privacy Enhancing Technology Symposium community. And there was a beautiful saying there. One of the things I learned when I got into that community, anonymity loves crowds. It was beautiful because it gave me some hope. Not hope that, oh, I can do bad things and remain anonymous, but hope that as a human being, there is still an area of respite from technology, through anonymity, through crowds. And I really wonder whether we are eroding that, in the sense that we are walking towards the absence of offline and online anonymity. This is particularly challenging, and here I'm driving back the results to my behavioral work, because, hey, we don't anticipate, evolutionary speaking, we don't expect that when we are in an area outside in public, the people who don't know anything about us will recognize us, unless we are celebrities. We don't anticipate that they could infer something much more sensitive about us. And there is no obvious solution to all of this. Because really, the key messages I hope you bring home from this talk are that your face cannot be easily changed. Eric Schmidt, famously of Google, said maybe when people turn 18, we should give them the ability to, you know, do a kind of reputation clean, wipe out, create a new name, a new reputation. Changing your name is much less costly than changing your face. Your face is the veritable conduit between the online and the offline world, the dating site, and your face in the street, as well as your multiple persona in the online world. And that is not going to change. The emergence of PPI, personal predictable information. We no longer have only personal information and PII, personal identifying information. Now we will have personal predictive information. So inferences that people make about you, and you know what, 80% of the time will be correct because algorithms will get better and better. 20% of them will be wrong. And to be honest, I'm concerned about both the scenarios. The scenarios when they are correct about you, and the scenarios where technology will make bad inferences about you, the people will make decisions upon in real time. Social networks and real IDs. Pretty much we have created a de facto real ID infrastructure. Americans tend to be against real ID. We have seen it in the history of the Real ID Act in the United States. Well, we have created one through online social networks. Why? Because so many of us post photos and so many of us post identified profiles. The rise of visual searchers. You can imagine how search engines in the close future will allow facial searchers. Some of them have started allowing visual searches based on pattern recognition. The democratization of surveillance, which I don't mean as a good term, it means a world where you can search for a face and find personal information about that face, but also the other person can do it on you. And the future of privacy in this augmented reality world. And when talking about augmented reality, really to stress this combination of online and offline data. What will privacy even mean when we are really into this future, of which we only show the proof of concept, still primitive by all means, but really this is the future where online and offline data blend in real time seamlessly. Because this is the biggest story. From an anonymous face to a matching face to the name, to the online data you have about the name, to the sensitive inference you can find to the online data, back to the anonymous face. So the last comment I make is that there are not just the privacy implications, there are the behavioral implications. Going back to my background in behavioral research, think about this. We human beings have evolved for hundreds of thousands of years this ability. We have fine-tuned this ability of assigning trust in face-to-face interactions. We meet a person, we immediately decide how much we can trust the person. Is this person good or bad? We feel it, it's skin level. We have evolved to do that. Well, now we have technologies which, in a way, plug themselves straight into this process, because they can make inferences about the person we are looking at, which are not based on our evolution, they are based on what you can find online and how good the algorithms are about them. So will we trust our instinct, or will we trust our technology when the technology is entering this process. And to give an example, I've been told that the results of my study are a bit too gloomy, so I choose sometimes to have a slightly less gloomy endings, and I will use one, which I use a black hat, and I hope you will not be offended by the incredibly high level of stereotyping and cheapness I will display in the following image. There are two people in a bar. They have not met each other before, and they are engaging in the preliminary phases of some form of mating. But they have the technologies that we developed. They have our phone that can take a photo of them, and then secretly they can look for any information they find about the person. So the guy is thinking, I'm going to see if she's on adultfriendfinder.com. And the girl is thinking, I'm going to check his credit score. So this is cheap. You can stereotype me, say I'm Italian, like pizza, play mandolino. So I'll completely allow you. But the bigger picture is there is a movie we all watched a few years ago, Minority Report, where this face recognition technology is very common. And there are two possible usages of many displaying the movie. The commercial advertising personalization image and the surveillance image. One of these two futures is creepier than the other, but to be honest, I found both of them concerning in the sense that I feel the privacy and anonymity are part of what makes us human. They are areas of respite that we need for being humans, and in a way, we are eroding that pretty quickly. I don't know where this will bring us, but I know that we should be prepared, and this is why we are doing this kind of study. Thank you for your attention. If you have any questions, there are a few more minutes. I know that there is also lunch, so I'm not offended if you guys all want to storm towards lunch, but if you have questions, I'm also happy to answer.
Konstantin Beznosov, UBC. So it looks like at least your earlier paper results confirm this anecdotal belief that the newer generations of online users will care less and less for their privacy, because if they come into the online world that already has less privacy, they will be not valuing more privacy according to what you have. Do you agree with
it's possible. I say it's possible rather than making a firmer, stronger statement, because I feel it's a research question. It should be studied and analyzed, and I know people start thinking about that. It's possible. I'm not going stronger with this because there is this issue of age versus cohort. How much your privacy attitudes and your privacy behavior is affected by your age, versus how much of it is affected by the particular cohort you're part of, and therefore the environment you are growing up in. And it is certainly arguable, and it is possible that for kids who are born in a world where there is already less privacy, they will come out with very different perceptions of what should be public and what should be private than the rest of us. That will not mean that they have zero sense of privacy. Dana Boyd has done work showing how kids try to find alternative ways of protecting their privacy even in public, but it does mean that they are more attuned to disclosure, and I would drive this. If I can enlarge the domain of my answer by pointing out that there is this broader issue, not just the age issue, but the age of the issue of habituation. And Tara in the previous talk mentioned this: how we get habituated to more and more invasions. We seem to change our barometer for what constitutes an invasion based on what has happened before. And the trend seems to be that we are getting adjusted to more and more disclosures. What worries me about this is that I see privacy as control, but not control as in the study I mentioned during my talk, control of your personal information. The crucial issue of control with privacy is the control that allows that your personal information gives others on you. To me, the very important issue of privacy and control is that if information is power, control over personal information means control over the person.
Thanks.
I'm Alan Schiffman. I have an observation and a question. The observation is that perhaps, you know, in some cultures, going about in public masked, you know, with your face covered. With your face covered, going about in public with your face covered. In some cultures, that's acceptable and getting increasingly acceptable. I'm not just referring to Islamic societies. I'm also speaking of downtown Tokyo, downtown Hong Kong. In the name of pollution or, you know, whatever, people go about with surgical masks on their face, with handkerchiefs tied over their face. So you could imagine a few years from now some fashion statement, you know, people wearing sunglasses, celebrities. It's not inconceivable that there could be a fashion trend of making yourself more anonymous by covering up your face. That was the observation. The question is, with respect to the instability of judgment, you know, by framing it, the first study, for example, where people will take $2 to give away their privacy, but will pay the same $2 perhaps to guard it. Might this instability of decision-making be that people aren't so great at making abstract judgments about their privacy? If you framed with respect to a concrete issue, like for $2 give away your social security number or something, perhaps their decisions might be... Do you get my distinction between abstract value and a concrete loss?
Definitely.
Is it conceivable that the decisions be more stable?
Two great points. So first, although the first was an observation rather than a question, let me comment on something. And I know you didn't put it forward that way, but I fear a future where our only way of protecting privacy is that we always have to go around masked all the time, right? But there is, by the way, a very interesting relationship between masking and privacy studied by, I feel I'm only 90% likely to be correct. Murphy was an ethnographer, spent some time with Tuareg, you know, the blue men, North Saharan tribes, who dress with this very beautiful blue clothing, and they cover most of their face. He found that there was a correlation between power and how much of your face you could cover. And I guess you will not be surprised to know that the more powerful you were in the society, the more you could cover your face. If you only showed your eyes, you were probably the most highest in ranking in the community. If you were lower in ranking, you had to show more of your face. We show visibly a direct correlation between power and privacy. About the malleability of valuation. So the endowment effect, which is one of the causes of our results in the study you're referring to, has been shown time and again both for physical good and abstract non-physical goods. So it has been shown with mags, and it has been shown with environmental policies. So it seems to be something universal that over the way we human beings assign value. However, the numbers we found were really on the high end of the scale, really on the high end of the scale, much higher than typically found with physical goods, suggesting that perhaps there is something in the arbitrarity, in the difficulty and uncertainty of assigning a value to your data, which makes then your valuation swing even more when you bring in scenarios such as ours. We didn't do it with the, we didn't test it against the social security number, but we tested it against other data, such as rather than most of the time when we do these studies, I present only one study for each story, but to get published in the kind of journals we have to publish, we often have to do, you know, four or five other experiments to show the robustness of the results. So one of the robustness experiments we did that I didn't show was we tried with different types of information, we found the same effect. It was not social security number, in one case it was health data, and I don't remember now what was the other type of information, but we found the same effect.
Okay, good, thanks.
Thanks.
Hi, I'm Joss Wright from University of Oxford.
Hi.
It's probably a slightly unfair question, but I'm interested in the scale and the scope and things like cultural effects in the various studies. And also I noticed things like when you told the story about the person who handed in the wallet that had $10,000, it was a he and not a she. We weren't necessarily talking about adults versus children, and certainly, obviously, in different cultural contexts, different. Do you have any results? Do you have any ideas? Do you have any intuitions about how that might change and what that might mean for privacy in different cultures?
That's a beautiful question. My challenge will be trying to answer in just a couple of minutes, because I know there is lunch, because this could go on for hours. So, I'll start with some basically factual points and then get to the big picture. Factual points: for the wallet experiments, Mr. A was a guy. We didn't find any statistical significant impact of gender of the subjects in their way they reacted to Mr. A. So male and females in our sample reacted the same way. We also did another, the dictator game. Thank you for asking me the question, because I remember now that I wanted to tell you about the dictator game and I never told you about the results of the dictator game. In the dictator game, was the one where our subjects were given real money and they had to give part of the money to the other player. And we're given different information about how this other player played in the past. Either was very, very greedy, kept all the $1 for himself or herself, or in the recent past or in the distant past, or was very generous. We found that if the other player had been generous recently, our players were more generous to him. If this guy had been or girl had been generous in the past, they were not generous at all. While instead, if this person had been greedy, they would punish the greediness regardless of whether it was recent or past. Okay, so I'm bringing this up again because this other player was discussed as a it. So it was presented as player 1, 2, 3 zeta alpha. It was no gender, and we still found the same effect. Broadly speaking, the impact of gender, age, culture on privacy attitudes and behavior is unquestionable. What we try to do when we do this kind of experiments, we take a reductionist approach. We cannot answer all possible questions at the same time. So we try to take large enough samples that we can randomly split in different groups, and they are large enough even after being split in groups that we can enter then in the analysis of the results, such as in economic regression, controls for gender, for age, for culture, for where they come from, and so forth. It's not the ideal if we were trying to only focus on that question, but we also have other ongoing studies in which we focus on culture. And one of the ongoing studies, for which I don't have results yet, we are trying to, using longitudinal data from Facebook, we are trying to answer the question whether when foreign students come to, say, to CMU, and they change their Facebook profile from what they had, for instance, in India, or they create a new one, does their information revelation signature pattern changes after some time they've been here in the US compared to what was before? Because we're interested in almost this culture versus nature, nurture debate of how sensitivity and behavior change. I guess the last question.
Hi, Ben Lefschetz, Microsoft 3CH. Right. I really enjoyed your talk. I think it's really great. But let me sort of say the following, which is, I feel there is a lot of emphasis on the downside, if you will, of privacy laws and, you know, things that can go wrong and the element of surprise that users often experience when they see their, you know, private data all over the web and things like that. And I should point out that I fully appreciate that. I think the pets community sort of, you know, has made a number of important contributions in that very direction. But I really wonder what you think about the potential upsides, which is to say that in real life, we really often trade off our privacy in exchange for services and goods, and those don't really have to take the form of a $10, you know, card or a $12 card. Those potentially have much more ranging sort of effects. Like, you have a relationship that goes on for years with your bank, for instance, and your bank knows so much more about you than, you know, you can learn from Facebook in terms of buying patterns, right? So, but presumably most people feel that it's probably okay to engage with their bank. Whether that decision is justified or not, we can argue about that. But still, there is a sense of an upside that, you know, exists in our society. So I sort of wonder, I think my question is, what potential benefits do you see and what kind of exchange sort of market do you see for the downside of loss of privacy? What is the upside? What's your uplifting message?
So it's another beautiful question. The challenge, once again, is that the question arrived before lunch. So I'll try to give a short answer, and then if you're interested, we can continue this offline. The short answer is that as a researcher, by necessity, you know, when you are in academia, you have to focus. And I focus on privacy risk, because that's also what my privacy decision making to me highlights many privacy risks, because that's what my research is about. I don't imply by this that any information disclosure is negative, not at all. That would be foolish. I try when I go back to economics to think in terms of global costs and benefits, the pros and the cons. But I also have the challenge there that when I try to come out with a single number, I realize that coming out with a single number, trading off the benefits and costs, is foolish. It's impossible, in the sense that at the end of the day, there are so many dimensions to the problem, so many ways of weighting these pros and these cons, that there is no single answer to the question, overall, are we better off or are we worse off? What I would say by saying worse off or better off is that I'm a strong believer in privacy-enhanced technologies. That's how I first came to the community. And I really wish that there were more practical implementation. Maybe we need more policy intervention of the smart type of fostering the development, the deployment in the marketplace of privacy enhanced technologies, which could allow, I'm not a dreamer, I know that there will be limitations, but they could allow information to be shared, benefits to be gathered, while data also to be protected. That's where I stop as a researcher and I start as a dreamer, hoping for the future. Thank you.